And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest, Jeremy Bailenson, who has written Experience on Demand. It's a book about virtual reality. Jeremy is the professor of communication at Stanford University and founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. He offers expert guidelines for interacting with VR and describes the profound ways this technology can be put to use to hone our performance, help us recover from trauma, improve our learning, and even enhance our empathic and imaginative capacities so that we can treat others and ourselves better. Jeremy Bailenson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's just great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You know, you have people that fly in from all over the world to visit your center, the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. And I want to talk, you know, we're going to talk about the book and get into all of that. But I had to ask you before we started, if you could tell us about your lab.
So my lab at Stanford, I founded it in 2003, and before that I worked at a lab at UC Santa Barbara, so I've been working in VR since 1999, but in 2003 we founded the lab at Stanford where we built immersive virtual reality hardware systems and rooms where you could run experimental subjects to try to understand what's the psychological effect of being in VR, how can you build applications that actually help people. And then in about 2010, Stanford put in a lot of resources to make it just an amazing space where it's got a floor that shakes to move your legs up and down, and it's got an ambisonic sound system with 24 channels that can move sound around the room so that it comes from the right spot. We've installed virtual scent. So it's from a hardware standpoint, it does sight, sound, touch, and sometimes scent really well integrated. So it's a destination for people to come and learn what is this virtual reality thing and what do I need to know about it?
Exactly. I have to admit, until recently, I've been under the impression that virtual reality applications were really dominated by gaming. And after meeting you in person in early November at the virtual conference in Park City, and also after reading your book, my eyes are now open to just groundbreaking tools that you are all developing and other people are developing in education, pain management, social VR, which is fascinating in itself. For our listeners who are not familiar with VR other than gaming, tell us what the possibilities are today and in the future.
You know, it's funny. When this so-called consumer revolution happened in, 2013, 2014, beginning, in 2014 with when Facebook buys this company called Oculus and HTC coming out with a product called the Vive and Google with their cardboard, in this moment in 2013, 2014, you had all these new companies, tech companies, Hollywood companies coming in and trying to, kind of foist their template of media onto what virtual reality should be. And that's where you saw people trying to make movies in VR and to do journalism in VR and all these kind of applications that worked really well with traditional media. What we're finding is that the really sticky applications are the things that the kind of pioneers of VR have been studying for 20 years. These are things like using virtual reality to distract you from pain. It's such a distracting medium, you literally feel your body less, and you can use it as a replacement for opioids. Using VR to replace travel. So if you've got a business meeting and maybe a video conference isn't good enough because you really want to have this nonverbal contact, then you can all beam in inside of virtual reality. The biggest application is training. I mean, why do we have virtual reality? Because in 1929, Edwin Link wanted to learn how to fly a plane, but he didn't want to do it from a manual. So what we're seeing this model of why do you do a flight simulator? Because it's cheap to make mistakes. You don't hurt yourself. You can repeat yourself on demand as often as you want, and you can have this kind of perfect training regimen. And this year in 2019, we just finished, we being a company I co-founded called Striver, we just finished installing 17,000 virtual reality training systems in Walmart stores. So every single Walmart store in the entire country has between 2 and 4 virtual reality training systems where employees, and 1 million employees will go through this in 2019, 1 million people training in VR. They'll do things like practice how to talk to customers who are angry and to deal with holiday rush where the cacophony is all around them and people are upset, and how to spot a safety violation quickly. Is there a sharp knife on the counter? And we've actually been working with Walmart now for 3 years to help them come up with these simulations to make their employees better. So it's actually the non-gaming applications of VR that are proving to be really sticky. And it's interesting that the ones that scholars have been working on for about 20 years, these are the ones that actually are gaining the traction.
Well, Jeremy, what a great thing to start a company and then have one of your first clients be Walmart. That's a pretty good way to do things. I wanted to ask you about some definitions. We know that, you know, when we talk about virtual reality, we're also hearing about augmented reality and mixed reality. And I think that sort of confuses people who are just learning about virtual reality. Can you give us a little snapshot, maybe some examples of the three?
Yeah, I'm thrilled to. And you know what? I'm going to solve a problem for your listeners. There's really only two. Okay, there's virtual reality and augmented reality. And virtual reality is complete mental transportation. You feel like you're in a different place. You can't see the real world. The scene responds to your body. You can't hear things. You are completely mentally transported to a different place. And that's what virtual reality is. Augmented reality, you're wearing glasses that are very similar to the glasses that you'd wear, similar to sunglasses or prescription glasses, and we augment a layer on top of those glasses. So you're seeing light from the real world, but you're seeing a digital layer. So, for example, you could be seeing name tags floating on top of people's heads so that you always know their name. And the technology that goes behind these two are fairly similar, but from a psychological standpoint, very different. Think of virtual reality as this intense journey and experience where you become someone else or do something impossible. Augmented reality is much more of a multitasking tool. So you basically get to navigate the real world while you get a layer of information that can help you, you know, understand the world better, get a tour in real time as you're walking around, get better navigation, etc.
Jeremy, I just want to mention that you are a professor of communication at Stanford University, which might surprise some people that you don't really come from a tech background. And I think this is important because that those of us who are maybe late adopters to technology, we think it's all about the technology component, but really it's so much about the human component. And as you talk about the communication component, can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, so thanks for pointing that out. I'm a professor in the Department of Communication. I have an appointment in the Department of Education, and I'm also an appointment in Symbolic Systems, which is a cognitive science at Stanford. And my PhD was actually in cognitive science in the late 90s, where I did a fair amount of coding and artificial intelligence work to try to make models of how the brain works. I then did a four-year-long postdoc at UC Santa Barbara, where I learned how to do the engineering to build VR and the coding to build the content. But in 2003, I switched to the Department of Communication, and I think that's an important point, which is, you know, for me, virtual reality is a medium, and, you know, we should think about it as a medium and think about it in terms of, you know, what are we going to do given this technology? The book is called Experience on Demand because, in my opinion, we should think of VR as an experience. It's forget the gadgets, forget the field of view and the pixels and the resolution and the latency and all this jargon. When VR is done well, the medium disappears. It becomes an experience. You're doing something. And what my research has shown over the last two decades is that when VR is done well, the brain tends to treat it in a similar manner as if it were really happening. And so I think for listeners, what we should think about as you decide whether you're going to do virtual reality or not, think about it as, do you actually want to do that experience? Because the brain does tend to treat it as if it were happening to you.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jeremy Bailenson, who has written Experience on Demand, What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, What It Can Do. Just want to quickly give a quote of the Wall Street Journal. If you want to understand the most immersive new communications medium to come along since cinema, I'd suggest starting with Mr. Bailenson's book. It really is quite a primer and answers a lot of questions. One thing I was absolutely fascinated by was the early days of Striver, when you started working with Stanford football coach David Shaw and quarterback Hogan. Tell us about that, because every week a quarterback has to face a new opponent, and there's 170 or so plays that are brought into the playbook for that specific game, and of course you're playing against a defense that has different ways of playing their blitzes and moving pieces around, and you've got to get those looks. So talk about how virtual reality helps in that particular aspect.
So quarterbacks go through during the week something that's actually called installation. And what that means is there's all these plays, there's all these special defensive packages from the team they're going to play that weekend, and they've got to learn all of these plays. But they're learning it from watching video shot from a strange angle or from looking at X's and O's. And what we decided to do for a master's thesis here at Stanford from Derek Belch was let's give them virtual reality experiences so they can better learn these plays and better practice making decisions. And so it's important to note, we're not teaching them how to kick and throw and run. They do that on the field, and we're not replacing actual practice. It's critical to have physical practice. We're giving them extra mental repetition. So when a quarterback goes to the line of scrimmage, he's got to very quickly look around left, right, try to recognize that defensive pattern. Everybody's running around trying to fool him. There's a loud noise of the crowd screaming at him. And in those few seconds, he's got to decide, do I keep the original play, or do I kill, and go to the next play down the queue? And what we initially started doing, this is back in 2013, was building VR simulations to let the quarterbacks practice looking around, recognizing that pattern, and then making this decision, do you keep the original play or go to the next one? And what we built this, and Coach David Shaw, who's just a genius, a forward-thinking individual, he donated us 5 minutes of practice time on Monday, which is a huge deal. Coaches choreograph practice down to 30-second chunks, and Coach gave us 5 minutes. And what we did in those 5 minutes was we'd have the Stanford defense pretend to be the team we're going to play that Saturday and throw around these very complicated blitz packages. We would record it in 360 video, stitch it together, and then the quarterbacks would then practice going through these plays. After 3 weeks, Coach saw it was working so well that he made it mandatory for the players to use. And that season, Stanford outperformed expectations. Both Coach Shaw and our quarterback at the time, Kevin Hogan, attribute virtual reality as one of the many things that helped them that season do so well. And then the neat thing was Derek graduates, I think it was January 2nd, 2015, and you know, he forms Striver, the startup, on January 3rd, and then proceeds to shock the world by signing 6 NFL teams to multi-year contracts in the first month or two the company was in business. So it went on this kind of meteoric rise where we had to figure out, well, how do we do this now?
Well, Striver has NFL customers and also has collegiate customers. And when I was watching the national championship game between Clemson and Alabama, I was amazed at how adept freshman quarterback for Clemson, Trevor Lawrence, was against Alabama's defense. I know that Clemson uses this system. What role did this have in Trevor's preparation and Trevor's success?
Yeah, there's a really fun YouTube video that I can share, which is Dabo Swinney, the coach of Clemson, just waxing poetic for 6 continuous minutes at a press conference about all the different ways he uses Striver. And yes, the quarterbacks use it voraciously, but there's also, they use it on defense, they use it for the kickers to gain confidence. They are, you know, this is a tool that helps. You know, it helps someone that hasn't gotten that experience on the field to get extra repetitions. I mean, think about the backups. And we got to see this in the championship game. These are players that didn't play all season long. They don't get experience on the field. They don't get to practice, do full-on scrimmage during practices. They get very few repetitions. VR gives them extra mental repetition, this mental toughness that lets you prepare. And again, we would never take away from the brilliance of the players and the coaches in their job, but using Striver, it was a tool that helped them this season.
Well, I'd just love to talk about football the rest of the time, but I'm going to switch gears here. Let's talk about, I mean, how virtual reality changes us cognitively and maybe go into how it creates more empathy. You give an example in the book about, you know, you walk down the street, you see a homeless person, and you can sort of think through what they must be experiencing, but you'll never get to the place that you would get cognitively and even consciously, right? Unless you're doing some sort of really putting yourself into their shoes. Can you talk about how an experience in virtual reality with someone like this, like a homeless person, is going to change us depending upon, you know, what our profession might be?
One of the ways that we increase empathy and then pro-social behavior based on that empathy is doing something called perspective taking, which is a cognitive technique that's been around, you know, in the academic publications for a few decades, and of course in the world for as long as humans have been thinking. And this is the ability to really feel what it's like to walk a mile in someone else's shoes and to think about what they're going through in a productive manner. And the thing about trying this with your imagination is, first of all, it's very difficult to do. It takes a ton of cognitive energy. It's hard to do it right. Second is, we often don't have the proper information to form a good narrative. In other words, if I'm imagining what it's like to be a woman, I may have stereotypes that I'm operating on, and I don't have the actual information. So when I imagine it, I do it improperly. What neuroscientists discovered about a decade ago was something called body transfer, which is that when you wear virtual reality helmets and you look down and you see your body in the first person, you move your right arm up, and you look down and you see your avatar, that's the representation of you, move its right arm, and you're experiencing, you know, wearing someone else's body. It takes about 4 minutes of you moving your physical body, seeing that synchronous movement on your virtual body in the first person, for the brain to basically treat that avatar as an extension of you. And so this is critically important because there has been a methodology innovated where you can basically, you know, fool the brain into thinking that a body that's not yours, one that's in virtual reality, is yours. And the next step in the empathy work is you basically walk up to, say, a virtual mirror, and you're moving around physically and you're seeing your avatar move virtually with you. And, you know, in our experiments, you walk up to the mirror and we hit a button, and I would go from a white male, I'd become a woman of color, and I'd actually feel in my body and my brain what it's like to be a woman. I would do body transfer so that I would actually really identify with this new identity. And then in the next stage of the experiment, we would network in a second person. That person would come up to you and they'd see you. You would look down and see yourself, whoa, I'm still a woman of color. And then there would be a social interaction where this person would treat you poorly. And you would actually experience some type of negative behavior, whether it was saying something badly or nonverbally ostracizing you, or even in some cases physically assaulting you. You'd walk a mile in someone else's shoes and feel what it's like to experience prejudice. What our studies have shown for 15 years, including a very recent publication that we talk about in the book in Chapter 3, which had two components. One was a very large sample with lots of people who weren't college students, older people, younger people, different socioeconomic statuses. And the second study was a longitudinal one where we looked 2 months later. So you'd be, you know, do this virtual experience and you'd become homeless, or you would, say, read a narrative or role play in your mind. And then 2 months later, we'd compare your behavior. And what both studies have shown is that virtual reality compared to traditional perspective taking causes longer term empathy and behavior compared to control conditions.
So interesting. So can you comment at all on the research that's been done perhaps with a functional MRI to see if people are experiencing empathy to the point that they're also showing, you know, anxiety or dread or depression or shame internally from, like, a functional MRI?
So one of my colleagues at Stanford that's involved in all the empathy research I do, his name is Jamil Zaki, and he's a social neuroscientist and an expert in empathy. And working with Jamil, you know, we're very careful. Jamil began this collaboration and still remains, I don't want to say a skeptic of VR, but, you know, he rightfully believes that VR is not a magic medium that's going to cause all the world's problems to go away. It's really about what you do with the experience. And so I often get asked, does VR cause empathy? And I say, well, you never ask same question about the medium of the radio. You would basically say, well, it depends on what you say. And VR is the same way. And Jamil's got a lot of background on how to not induce what's called empathy fatigue. For example, you don't want people to be, you know, negatively affected by these simulations. You don't want them to become so turned off by it that it causes a negative association between the people they met in VR and the ones they're later going to meet in the real world. So we're really careful about that. And the way we're careful is that I work with not just virtual reality people, but domain experts, and in this case, arguably the world's expert in empathy.
I understand there's quantifiable data in reading on absence makes the pain grow fainter. That's one of your chapters in your book, where 95% of the time, if a person in pain is playing Nintendo, only 95% of the time they experience that same searing pain. But they've quantified that in the virtual reality world that you can get that down significantly, as low as 2%.
Yeah, so this is one of the early studies by Hunter Hoffman showing that when you have burn victims and you're changing their bandages, when they're in immersive virtual reality, they almost never think about the pain. They're in VR and they're doing snow world. It's very cold, and they're lobbing snowballs at snowmen, and there's good loud music playing, and it's really immersive and consuming, and they're mentally transported out of their bodies while the nurse is doing a very painful procedure on these veterans. They're pulling off the bandages and cleaning the wounds. They almost never see a thing about their pain in that condition. The control condition in Hunter Hoffman's early studies was playing Nintendo. And in that instance, even though it's very distracting and a better designed game, because the VR was very early back then, you're still thinking about your pain quite often. Now, the pain distraction research has been now, since those early studies, that was in the mid-1990s, there's been hundreds of experiments and some of them randomized control trials. And, you know, the effect sizes aren't as big as from 95 down to 1 or 2 percentage points. But in general, you see consistent reduction in pain when you're in immersive VR compared to, say, doing other types of media. It's a really useful and worthwhile tool that distracts you so much from your body you don't feel pain. And think about this in the context of the opioid addiction. If we can, you know, use VR instead of drugs for so many ailments that we can prevent getting people on this pathway to trying opioids, it's a really neat endeavor.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, Jeremy, but I wanted to ask you just a quick question before we let you go. Back in March of 2014, and you write about this in the book, Mark Zuckerberg visited your labs where you had him walk the plank and show him the center and everything. I think it was later that month that Facebook purchased Oculus, the market leader in VR goggles. Was there a connection to that visit and his desire to pick up Oculus?
You know, so Mark came to the lab and we spent a couple hours talking about a lot of the things we're talking about on this radio show, about, you know, how to use it for empathy, how to use it for communication, how to use it for social interaction. And, you know, Mark had done some VR, but not on the high end. He'd done more of the commercial stuff. And so we gave him a ton of VR and just talked about the different applications. And, you know, where I think Facebook is buying Oculus is not for the games and not even for the social networking. I believe that they're going to try to use this for literally redefining the future of computing. So instead of using a computer to access your data, using goggles and using this as a way to put people together and to increase connections. And so that's a lot what we talked about. The truth is, to directly answer your question, I can't really get in his head and figure out what caused him to buy that. I think we can say with confidence that at least the visit didn't get in the way.
Exactly. Well, Jeremy Bailenson is professor of communication at Stanford University and founding director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab. He has written a fascinating book titled Experience on Demand: What Virtual Reality Is, How It Works, and What It Can Do. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
What a great conversation, and I really appreciate it.
Okay.